So I'd like to continue now this session with beginning to look at metta a little bit more closely. First of all, to understand that it is metta that enables all of the other Brahma-viharas of compassion and joy and equanimity. That metta is this indispensable foundation. So I find in my own life these days, I much prefer to use this Pali word of metta, simply because I find that mostly the English translations tend to evoke certain amounts of emotional association. And in some ways, it's just easier. Some Pali words, it's actually easier to incorporate into our vocabulary rather than finding 10 English ones that seem to fit. So I would like to talk about metta. So this word has its roots in the verb to befriend, maitri. In Sanskrit, it is actually to grow fat with metta. It's my understanding of that translation that it has that connotation of growing fat with metta. But it is a verb form. It is a quality of befriending. It is not a state. It is an action. It is a psychological, emotional response of befriending. As a fruition now, metta is translated as a boundless, unimmeasurable, unshakable friendliness and kindness. As a practice, it is a process. It is a process of befriending or cultivating our capacity to meet all things with a mind of kindness. The mind of metta. I mean, personally, although I have a great respect for the translation loving kindness, it's not a phrase personally I ever use anymore. I think it's fine if you're happy with it and love to use it, please do so. But personally, I think the word love in our culture is a word that does carry a lot of emotional baggage that to some can feel overwhelming. We don't necessarily feel in many moments of our lives that we have the capacity to love what is happening. But we may have the capacity to stand near to something. And we may have the capacity to befriend the difficult. So I want to look at the attitude, the domain, and the practice of metta as an insight practice. So it first begins with establishing a particular quality of mindfulness. And bear in mind, in the Buddhist teaching, the word mindfulness or sati is used in a whole range of different ways. It's not just about eyeballing something more closely or, you know, being attentive. It's used in a whole range of different ways. And in the Metta Sutta, it's used as a quality of mindfulness. As it says in the discourse, standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, may one remain mindful of this heart and this way of living that is best in this world. Unattached to speculations, views, and sense desires, with clear vision, such a person will never be reborn in the cycles of suffering. This is not talking about some future life, by the way. It is talking about not being reborn in the cycles of suffering in this moment. It is a way of not taking a shape, a kind of birth, a shape in this moment that is shaped by ill will or fear of aversion. Never being reborn in a cycle of suffering, remaining mindful in this way. So mindfulness, as we probably have all experienced, mindfulness or sati in itself, it's an antidote to heedlessness, isn't it? It's an antidote to forgetfulness, including the forgetfulness of the very pivotal quality of metta in our lives. It is also true, and I think perhaps I would ask you to check this out in your own experience, that it may be evident to us that the proximate causes of forgetfulness are the hindrance factors. What is it that makes us forgetful? Just check that out in your own experience. When you find yourself dissociated, disconnected, lost, spaced out, you know, whatever ways we become forgetful. Look at what the proximate causes are for that. And often we do see in our own experience that what makes us forgetful, heedless, lost, our familiar friends, the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving to have something that is not here right now. Aversion is a big cause of forgetfulness, isn't it? Sloth and torpor, prime causes of forgetfulness. Restlessness and worry, doubt. Now, these states, these five states in themselves, are really considered, of course, in the Buddhist teaching to be the five manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. These are said to be the asavas, or the outflows of greed, hatred, and delusion, the way that which those patterns actually affect our experience or take form in our experience. They're states that cause disconnection, cause dissociation. This hopefully is not some abstract theory. Hopefully you can actually really inquire into that in your own experience. Now, the nature of mindfulness, as I mentioned before the break, the very nature of sati is to turn towards all things. The nature of metta is to befriend that which is turned towards. It's to be cultivating the willingness to stand near to or to stand next to all things, to befriend in a way to care for. This is also one of the translations of sati, or mindfulness, is to care for, to stay close to. And in this sense, the Buddha refers to metta as the highest mindfulness. Now, the practice of metta, as many of you have been taught it, of course, is using a few simple phrases to cultivate both the intention, the inclining of the mind, and to cultivate the concentration, keeping the mind steady, learning to steady the attention, not using the phrases as kind of empty recitations or mantras, but actually the phrases in themselves being articulations of intention, aspiration, and the very process of inclining towards metta. Now, if we were to use metta as a concentration practice, our attention would be primarily focused on keeping the phrases going, sustaining the phrases. You are familiar with that as a practitioner. May I be happy, may I be peaceful, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. So if we're using it as a concentration practice, our primary focus would be to keep these phrases uninterrupted as a concentration practice. Now, as an insight practice, we would actually change how we use the phrases somewhat. We would use, as an insight practice, we would use the phrases as anchors, Much as we would use mindfulness of breathing, for example, as an anchor in insight practice. Something that serves to bring our attention back when it gets lost. But as an insight practice, I would encourage you to allow much more space between the phrases, long spaces. Having a cultivating a quality of receptive attention and an inner listening to the responses to the phrases. Think of it like dropping a pebble into a pond and watching how the ripples expand. So may I be peaceful, or may you be peaceful. I drop that in. I sit with it. I listen to it. What kind of responses are arising? What kind of echoes are set off in the mind, in the heart? Many responses can arise. Boredom, disinterest, resistance, impatience, aversion. Now, do we recognize those reactions as reactions that arise in many areas of our lives that prohibit metta? This is a key part. We're using that internal microcosmic experience of our responses to the phrases very much as a mirror for seeing how those same reactions to the phrases arise in our life that prohibit metta being present. What happens with the sustained dedication to the phrases, you know, periodically, just coming back to them, what we're learning to do is to be undissuaded by those reactions and tendencies that arise. So resistance arises, aversion arises, boredom arises, it doesn't matter. That's not what we're interested in. What we're interested in is sustaining the inclination of the mind and beginning to steady the heart in that inclination rather than being lost in the reactions and the stories and the selfing that attach to them. So essentially, we're cultivating a mind that is inclined towards freedom rather than a mind that is creating and recreating the cycles of suffering that we find ourselves getting born into. Now, I'll go through this a little bit and then we'll take some time. So we use the in the traditional ways, or the more orthodox ways that we're taught metta, we use different domains of human relationship to serve as a mirror for how we engage with the spectrum of people who come into our world. We start with ourselves. May I be happy? May I be safe and protected? May I be peaceful? We offer these intentions inwardly and we listen to our responses. It's a very fertile ground for insight, isn't it? Many people find this in metta practice because we discover our self story. Perhaps we might recognize how much we long for peace, for happiness. Perhaps we discover the ways in which we tend to extend so much judgment or blame or shame inwardly. Perhaps we discover that we don't feel ourselves to be worthy of this kindness and care. We are understanding the creation of the self-story that arises in relationship to the metta phrase is then the invitation to cultivate a mind of non-clinging and non-selfing. It's one of the great insight gifts of metta. Metta is not about me. It's not about you. It's about developing a boundless befriending that embraces all things. So instead of trying to fix the self story, metta may allow us to see it as a story yet not where we are making our home. Instead, we're making our home in the more inclusive quality of metta that makes no distinction between self and other, but is concerned, and metta is concerned, with ending conflict and division. Perhaps we discover that we can stand near to the self story, that we can stand next to it, befriending it, making room for it, rather than piling dukkha upon dukkha. Metta, in its traditional way of teaching, then often turns to the benefactor. Sometimes the benefactor is another person, but also appreciating our own inner capacities for generosity and selflessness, we may also discover that we have mixed reactions to an external benefactor. Appreciation, maybe a tinge of resentment. Why do they have it so good when I don't? You know? They are an amazing person, they make me feel unamazing. They're so compassionate, but I'm not. And we become so curious about the way that the self story is as relational as the process of metta. Please notice this. We don't have an independent self story. It is always a positional self story. It's always a relational self story. Metta is intended to be as relational as the self story is. We turn our attention to the good friend, touching upon the nature of friendship, trust, acceptance, kindness, tenderness, affection. We might reflect on how we might be a good friend to ourselves and what gets in the way. Much of the path we travel of insight is actually discovering what it means to cultivate a mind and a heart that is a friend, that doesn't feel like an enemy. There's something that torments us, but something that we can be close to. Then in the traditional way of developing metta practice, we go to the more neutral person. And we actually discover how much of our lives, this is all insight stuff, by the way, this is not concentration stuff, we discover how much of our lives is governed by going towards the people and events we like and avoiding those that we don't like. And in the agitation of that endeavor, I might say that there doesn't seem to be much room for the innumerable beings in this world with whom we share no personal history or story. Because our attention is concerned in the endeavor of avoidance and getting close to what we like. Learning to tend to these people we think of as neutral and beginning to appreciate the more universal story of all beings, the longing to be cared for, respected and loved, the longing to be safe and protected, the longing to be free from pain, we begin to widen the circle of our concern and care, moving towards a more boundless friendliness. What I would want to just add, many of you are familiar with practicing within the four foundations of mindfulness. And the second foundation of mindfulness, of course, is the foundation of Vedana, the pleasant and the unpleasant sensation, experience, event, and that which is more neutral. The word neutral doesn't really come up in Buddhist teaching. It's actually that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. But what we see in insight practice, when we practice in the second foundation of mindfulness, where we're learning to attend to the Vedana tone of all experience, that our relationship to that middle ground of neither pleasant nor unpleasant is exactly the same as our relationship to all these beings in this world that with whom we share no personal story or history. That we have no ground for self-building in that. And so the mind tends then to move away, to disassociate, and to actually move towards that which is more pleasant. Then in traditional metta practice, we take our attention to the difficult people in our lives, the difficult parts of ourselves that we cannot accept. And we discover in this domain the suffering of alienation, of fear and mistrust, and how quickly we move into judgment and to blame, how quickly we move into the agitation of avoidance, or sometimes we just sink into despair and disconnection from others and from aspects of our own being. So here, I think we discover the heart of metta as an insight practice. Because what is the job of metta? Think about what is the job of metta? It's not to have nice feelings. The job of metta as an insight practice is primarily concerned with the understanding of and the uprooting of aversion. Think of the three big fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. The job of metta here is in the domain of hatred, of ill will, of aversion in all its forms. This is what it's concerned with. Essentially, with mindfulness, we're learning first to bring metta to aversion, to see it as suffering, to stand close to it. Metta is not about consoling ourselves. It's about liberating the heart and the world from the toxicity of aversion. One of the most deeply rooted habit patterns, one of the primary manifestations of ignorance and confusion. In looking... Actually, maybe it's a good moment to pause for a minute before I go on. Has anybody got anything you want to raise for some reflection? Yeah.
So when you're talking about things being neutral, when I practice metta, I have a really hard time with the when I get to things that are neutral. Is that like you're trying? Like, is it just uncomfortable maybe for my mind to deal with things that are neutral, so I'm always trying to move them to pleasant or unpleasant? Or I'm a little I have a hard time dealing with neutral. I almost always have some sort of negative feeling about things, which I guess means they're not neutral. But
no, but that probably comes as a secondary reaction. You know, I mean, first of all, I do actually think it's quite helpful to erase the word neutral. Because actually nothing is actually neutral in this life. It's actually sometimes we don't pay attention. Okay. But what is happening is that when you turn your attention towards the neutral sensation or the neutral person, there's no immediate imprint of association that is made in consciousness. So we don't say, oh, that's good or that's pleasant because blah, 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 blah. You know, I've experienced in this way before. I like it. It means something to me. You know, it's not unpleasant, which sets off the same process. You know, I don't like it. You know, I've got something to do. I've got something to fix. You know, when something's unpleasant, I've got a job to do here. You know, when something's pleasant, I've also got something, a job to do here, because I'd like to keep it close to me. When something is in the ground, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, there's not much for me to do there, is there? So there's no ground for self-building. There's no ground for self-building. There's not the ground of association. You know, there's not the ground of you know, this is a reason to avoid or to stay close to. And I think this is the discomfort of that middle zone, is I just feel a little bit lost. You know? I just feel a little bit lost. So if we look, first of all, the job of mindfulness, you know, the first job of mindfulness is actually to illuminate or to awaken the world into a present moment focus. And that when we see, when we really pay attention to that which we first consider to be neutral, of course it's not. It's actually not. There's no such thing as a vacuum of Vedana. It's actually just that we're not paying attention. Now, if we don't bring the mindfulness to look more closely, what we tend to do is to revert to more familiar patterns of reactivity. And as the Buddha said, at this middle ground of neither pleasant nor unpleasant, because we feel a bit lost in it and are floundering, actually becomes a springboard for craving. Either something's wrong, something's missing, or I don't like this kind of feeling of not having a ground, so my attention will start to move towards finding something that is more familiar and hopefully more pleasant. So it's not as if trying to make the neither pleasant nor unpleasant into something else in the job is the job here. I think the job here is actually just to really pay attention, to really be mindful, and to listen also inwardly. Can we befriend that space, stay close to, stand next to that place, which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant? If you kind of, you know, go on with that particular stream of investigation, I mean, you can see that much of the agitation in our life is actually around what we pile upon, the pleasant and the unpleasant. They're not sources of agitation, but we pile agitation upon them through, either trying to get rid of something or through trying to keep something. If you can stay simply out of that drama and that intensity, this ground of neither nor can be remarkably peaceful. So I just encourage, stay near to it. Don't feel like you have to do something with it or make it into something. We want to make it into something because that's when I'm also kind of more self-making. I think I'll probably get into that. And it's not about neither liking nor disliking. It's about that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. We're coming to a very primal level of perception and experience here. When the Buddha talks about equanimity, and I will go into this, but it's tomorrow. It's actually blowing out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So what we see with the pleasant, the association very closely with the underlying tendencies of greed or wanting. We see with the unpleasant, the underlying tendencies of aversion, resistance. What equanimity is doing, it is severing the link between the Vedana tone, the feeling tone, and the underlying tendencies. Is that clear? That is actually the job of mindfulness, and it is a job of equanimity, is to sever the link in perception between the Vedana tone and the underlying tendency. They're still pleasant, they're still unpleasant, but there is not craving, there is not aversion, and there is not delusion. And in many ways, that's equanimity. Yeah. Yeah.
My question has to do with, and maybe you're going to get into this, but the sort of making friends part. I've noticed that I've begun to be able to recognize my aversion or my agitation. And instead of reacting to it, which would either be walk away, try to get out of it, or blame, or, you know, have a tone of voice or something that is agitated, I try to just, okay, but it's sort of this stance of like, I'm not going anywhere. It doesn't feel friendly to the agitation. It feels just kind of like I'm not gonna get knocked off by this. So I guess my question has to do with, without getting caught up in telling myself how I should be? How does the friendliness towards it?
Well, I mean, I do hear something quite admirable in what you're saying in terms of having that kind of resolve not to walk down familiar pathways that you know always have the same outcome, you know, of more suffering. So I think it's very important to acknowledge, you know, and to respect the resolve in that. And I'm not sure that that's, you know, I would say that that probably is an aspect of metta. Because that resolve hopefully is arising from a place of not wanting to be continually reborn in these cycles of suffering. And the resolve to stay close to. The only thing you perhaps need to be quite careful of is that there's a near enemy to resolve, which is endurance. You know, a kind of, you know, more despondent feeling, rather than, you know, I just have to endure this, rather than a curious feeling of, okay, this is what's going on. Let me see how this feels. And I mean, really see the interlink between metta and mindfulness and sati. You have that resolve to stay close to, then the sati is bringing in the curiosity. Okay, well, what is this? What does this feel like? You know, how is this registering? How do I know it as this? So you're always kind of moving between metta and mindfulness. And I think it's just so important not to make this separation between these two. And, you know, if this is a kind of relatively new endeavor in your life, you know, it you know, rather than just fleeing or abandoning or getting lost, I mean, I think there's also a quality of there of being patient in actually exploring what that resolve is, where it goes to the edge maybe of being too tight, or where it goes to the edge of kind of losing it. But not, I think it's a very valid commitment. Yes.
My question has to do with not being averse to disagreement. That part of the practice is listening to somebody speak to you. They say something that you don't agree with, and maybe not responding right away until you feel somewhat calm with what they've said, and then responding. But not responding at all seems to be an aversion. That
it can be. It can be. If we are using metta as an insight practice, we need to bring in all of the qualities of insight, which is sometimes knowing, which includes metta in speech. You know, and the Buddha very much defines wise speech as words of metta. But he was never then just talking about sweet words. Or agreeable, you know, agreements when we don't agree. But it does bring in that whole domain of right timing, right tone, capacity to hear, capacity to listen, being mindful within ourselves of the origins of those words. You know, I mean, it's very weird the way that aversion can disguise itself as metta, particularly in meditators, I find, you know. I just really need to tell you something because I really care about you. But, you know, or somebody writes somebody a nasty note and signs it metta. You know, like, we need to be very, very careful. I mean, it's one of those domains that asks for so much clarity and so much investigation that we are not disguising aversion as metta. Then it's just a sentiment. It's actually not dedicated to ending suffering, which metta, as an insight practice, is really dedicated to uprooting aversion and to ending dissociation and suffering. I mean, there is a restraint element of metta that I'm going to come to because sometimes that is what metta is. But sometimes metta is not about restraint.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask about a feeling quality of metta. I practiced metta for many years and found it quite dry and just thoughtful. And then a teacher who came through Seattle encouraged us to begin metta with feeling happiness. When that was present, often a smile would appear in sitting. And then to go forward with that feeling tone, that warm feeling tone. And I found that to be remarkably different and beneficial. And I wondered if you would comment on that or your experience.
I have a number of different thoughts about it. I mean, first of all, I think I totally agree with that on one level. I think what we need to be careful of, you know, and I find when people do metta practice, they often really get into terrible, terrible difficulties because they think of it as an emotional response only. You know, so they're doing metta practice and they say, well, I don't feel anything, you know, I don't have any emotional response. So they think they're doing something wrong, whereas actually they're not doing something wrong. But they're encouraging the intention, the inclining. So it's quite actually helpful to accept that maybe I don't have to feel anything. Maybe I need to stay close to something. I think when it becomes dry, though, I think it is because we're using metta too much as a concentration practice. And we're not actually looking at the whole attitudinal positioning of our attention. Certainly when I encourage people to do metta practice, I always encourage to start with something that quite spontaneously, quite naturally, in quite uncontrived way, brings a smile to your face. You know, and for some people, you know, it's their puppy. You know, I mean, I always think, you know, I always think if nothing else works, think about penguins. Who cannot smile when you think, you know, I mean, who cannot smile? It's just something quite unforced. And it's something about starting with that sense of ease, which is like deeply important. Like, we're not trying to make something happen here. We're acknowledging that the seeds of metta already lie within us, and that we have all experienced and tasted those seeds. And so part of the sati element of metta is remembering that capacity, even in the most difficult moments of our lives, remembering that capacity, because it is building upon that capacity and seeds, something that is already there that we cultivate and strengthen and grow, that we then actually bring into situations where it's not so easy and not so natural. So there's the two sides, not having the expectation that metta has to be a particular emotional response, but recognizing that there is an emotional tone of metta. I mean, if we think about the tone of metta, it is, certainly in Buddhist psychology, it is an emotional tone. It is a conscious cultivation of wholesome emotional tones that are permeated with insight, that allow us to actually let go of unhelpful emotional tones. So it is not emotionally blank. But we may actually start either with a remembering, the sati element, of where it comes naturally, or we may start with the inclining of the heart towards. We need to figure that out for ourselves, what's actually going to work. But not the expectation that if I do metta practice, I just turn into some sort of little Miss Sunshine, you know, completely devoid of discernment, you know, or insight, you know, and just, yeah. So it's both, I would say. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about going back to the pleasant, unpleasant, or even naming. which I've always found really helpful, but there are a lot of times where I don't know what it is. And sometimes kind of like trying to parse it down just doesn't feel right. So I've gone to, I don't know what, I don't know. I mean, is that neutral?
Well, if you don't know, you don't know. That's the simple truth of it in that moment. I mean, it's also, you know, very often Vedana tones are interplaying, aren't they? They're some pleasant, unpleasant edge, you know. I mean, you look at something like piti or rapture, for example, in concentration practices. Part of it can be really pleasant, part of it can be quite unpleasant, Vedana tone. But the simple reality is that sometimes we don't know. Now, what is that not knowing rooted in? Is it rooted in the fact that we're not mindful in that moment or not particularly clear? Or is it rooted in the fact that we're trying to find a languaging for something that feels more complex?
Yeah.
You know? And if we're trying to find a languaging for something that feels more complex, it's actually better just to rest. And actually, I'm not sure. Let it be. I can still stay close to it. I can even stay close to the sense of confusion that might arise. But better to have that attitude of metta, of staying close to the not knowing, rather than the agitation of I have to figure this out. Okay, should we go on a bit? So where we just ended there was actually really looking at the heart of metta. What is the job of metta as an insight practice? And its primary concern is this very powerful, very pernicious, very pervasive underlying tendency of aversion. So when the Buddha, in looking at his own mind and in looking at the world around him, certainly the Buddha recognized that there is no greater force than aversion to create disconnection, fear, and division in individuals, in families, in society. And it's interesting, I mean, aversion is not a word that we really, I mean, normally in English, I don't think we use this word very much, do we? I mean, not one you hear on the street that much. I don't, anyway. But aversion has so many dimensions, and I think it's very important to unpack those dimensions, because it's very easy to delude ourselves to think, well, I don't have aversion. Yeah, I don't go around, you know, shouting at people or, you know, kicking dogs or, you know, no, I'm aversion exempt. There's a lot of dimensions. Irritability, impatience, frustration, judgment, ill will, prejudice, contempt, envy. The list is very, very long. I even think of fantasy as a kind of aversion, because it is so much the kind of wish to be elsewhere, anywhere else but here. Numbness is a kind of aversion. Aversion can, what we see is aversion is fertile, it's active. Aversion is not passive. Aversion is active, it seeps. This is why the Buddha called it an outflow. You know, an outflow. It seeps through our speech, our thoughts, and then a turn, of course, can govern our actions and choices. We want to avoid, sometimes we want to even annihilate what we feel we cannot bear to be with. What we feel we cannot bear to be with. So let's look at how that kind of pans out in metta practice, as you've often been familiar with it. By our willingness to stay close, for example, to the difficult person, what makes a difficult person? Two dimensions to that, of course. One may be there, quite objective, actions, behaviors, whatever. And of course, a difficult person is the other half of that, is our own difficulty with the difficult person. I mean, this is a package job here. By staying close to the difficult person in more formal metta practice, we're actually withdrawing our consent from feeding those patterns. we're starving the pattern of abandonment. It's a kind of fasting process. If we think that any habit pattern for its survival and its deepening, including the habit pattern of aversion, it needs to be fed. If you don't feed a habit pattern, it doesn't have a long survival prospect. It has to be fed. So by staying close to the difficult person in more formal practice, we are not just that we're trying to make something happen or that we're, you know, trying to make a particular emotional response come into being, we're actually starving a different emotional response. And the emotional response we're starving, of course, is the one of pushing away, of resistance, of judgment, of blame. So by not feeding that, we stay near to, we include, and we develop in that doing that our capacity to befriend. We're learning to calm the impulses of fear, of rejection, of avoidance, and we're starving the impulse of aversion. But we're also bringing the attitude of metta to the aversion. That is so crucial. That this is actually suffering. The Buddha speaks of aversion as suffering. If metta is concerned with uprooting suffering, it's not about getting over aversion, it's not about judging aversion, it's not about personalizing aversion. It is recognizing that within human psychology, aversion arises in relationship to that which we fear. You know, so we are learning actually also to befriend the aversion, to make room for aversion. It can be there. It's not a sign of being a bad meditator. It doesn't have to go away. We don't have to annihilate it. If we try and annihilate aversion, by bringing aversion to aversion, we are simply feeding the pattern of aversion. Now, it's obvious to us that it's not just difficult people that stimulates aversion. Huh? If that would make life much simpler. As an insight practice, and I really want to stress this, metta extends to include all events and experiences. Metta is not just concerned with the domain of human relationship, it is concerned with the entire domain of human experience. So metta extends to embrace all events and experiences that stimulate aversion. I mean, think about this, if you're doing metta practice in the more traditional way of people. So we're sitting there with a benefactor, you know, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. And then your attention is drawn to a pain in your knee, an unpleasant sound, a difficult thought. And we feel some aversion or some resistance arise. As an insight practice, we would not rush back to the benefactor. You know, and try and kind of abandon that and rush back to the benefactor and say, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. As an insight practice, we would learn to bring the same attitude of befriending, of inclusivity, of spaciousness and kindness and care to the sensation in the knee, to the unpleasant sound, to the difficult thought. My apprehension is that we severely limit the potential and the capacity of metta if we think it only relates to human relationship and human experience. Metta relates to the arising of aversion and the uprooting of aversion wherever that appears. In the whole of our sensory world. I think if metta had a mantra, it would be this too, this too. This too, this too. What does it mean to stay close with that same attitude to the difficult sound, to the pain in the back, to the illness, to a life that crumbles? All of those events, part of our life, that can be such fertile ground for so much resistance and aversion and fear. This is where metta is actually asked for. to stay inclusive of all events and experience. Doing this in the formal metta practice, by the way, I would suggest, is simply a training for the whole of our lives. It's a training of learning to understand and to uproot aversion in all of our lives, how to be near the spectrum of adversity, difficult experiences and events, part of all of our lives, with courage and with kindness. It's a moment to moment. In my understanding, metta is a moment to moment exploring of what it means to live in a way that is ungoverned by aversion. And discovering the freedom of that. Nurturing the seeds of metta that takes us beyond the bounded to the unshakable and to the limitless. Does that make sense to you? Does that seem totally logical to you? So part of then of developing metta is really having that kind of inner sati, the inner alertness, to look in at where aversion and its all its different manifestations appears, and to have the commitment to not abandoning. Part of metta then is reaching out to care for, to stand close to include, to embrace. But the other dimension of metta, as we mentioned earlier, is restraint. Sometimes we don't think of metta as restraint. But knowing in our own experience and knowing in our own hearts what it is that leads to suffering, we essentially resolve not to be a participant in its creation and recreation. That's a huge resolve. To recognize that dukkha is not some sort of static state, that suffering is something that is created and recreated moment to moment through greed, hatred, and delusion. And resolving not to be a participant in its creation and recreation, we might restrain words of harshness or unkindness. We might learn to restrain thoughts that harm, whether they are directed outwardly or directed inwardly in terms of judgment or blame or shaming. We metta, and I think this is often the big underestimated piece of metta, metta protects the mind from obsession. It's that simple. It protects the mind from obsession. Metta is presented and taught as being a guardian of the heart, as being a guardian, actually, of the world. Using the phrases as a skillful means, we essentially do not give attention to destructive and toxic thought patterns that only entangle us in suffering. We learn to develop a well-trained mind. As I mentioned earlier on this morning, the Buddha says it's in a disciplined mind that knows true metta. Developing a well-trained mind, which, as the Buddha put it, actually, a well-trained mind, it thinks the thoughts it wants to think when it wants to think them. And it doesn't think the thoughts it doesn't wish to think, ever. It's quite a high bar, isn't it? It's a pretty high bar. But that is actually the aspiration of this practice. It's the aspiration of metta practice. It's the aspiration of mindfulness. It's the aspiration of the whole of the meditative developments that the Buddha talks about. Because that is the mind that is a friend. It is rooted in metta. It's free from the influences of greed, hatred, and delusion. And it has a sense of capacity. Creativity, capacity, clarity. So within metta as an insight practice, we're essentially learning and relearning the lessons of sila, of ethics, the lessons of wise effort, the lessons of letting go. We're learning to, and relearning what it is to listen inwardly, to be mindful of what's actually going on, to release the grip of ill will, and to sow the seeds of metta again and again and again, establishing ourselves in this mindfulness. In this mindfulness, which the Buddha described as the best way, of the way of living in the, that is best in the world.